afternoon, good evening, wherever you're joining us from, and thank you for joining the Localization Fireside Chat. My name is Robin Ayoub. I'm the founder and the host for this particular conversation on the Localization Fireside Chat today. We are recording episode 184, so thank you for joining me. I really appreciate it. And today, my guest of honor is Clayton Warwick, and we can't wait to get to know Clayton a little bit, get to know what he does, his personal journey, the company he works for, Word Bank. And we're trying to get to know two things today. We're trying to find out a little bit more about Clayton and a little bit more about Word Bank and what do they do and how can they help others in various industries. So, Clayton, welcome to the conversation.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me, Robin. Appreciate it.
Thank you for being with me. I really appreciate it. Let's get started with this. Everybody on this channel gets the easy question first, I guess, and just the warm-up, if you will.
Yeah.
The warm-up is, what's your story? What got you here?
Yeah, so a professional story. I'm closing in on 20 years as a professional marketer, and I've worked a number of agencies. Early in my career, I was in more traditional ad agencies, working on a lot of consumer packaged goods, things like that. Eventually got into digital marketing, which was, you know, it got to a point where it kind of became overly simplistic as we were working with US-based companies only and only advertising to US companies. So I wanted something a little bit more challenging. And so I decided to look at the world of, sorry, I got a notification that I lost. Did you lose me for a second?
Fine. I'm fine. I can still hear you. Don't worry.
All right. Technology. Yeah. So I decided to explore localization. That's when I went to Word Bank. Initially, I started off helping out build out their US digital marketing business, eventually took over their creative team, our creative team. And about 2 years ago, I was promoted to Vice President of Global Growth, where I now oversee our market strategy department, customer success department, as well as our marketing department. But really central to everything, I've always been a guy that just likes to introduce people to things that they'll love, whether, you know, in the early days, it was just a product that I thought somebody would love and I wanted them to buy it and enjoy it. In my music industry days, it was helping somebody find their new favorite song. And now working at Word Bank and working with streaming and entertainment industry, it's making sure people around the globe can connect with TV shows and movies that are, you know, so central to the human experience and our connection across borders.
So what does Word Bank do? Like, what's the main business of Word Bank?
Yeah, so we are a marketing localization agency, and we primarily or almost entirely serve the streaming and entertainment industry. The work that we do is, in essence, want, you know, no matter where the user is in the world, if they're accessing in Italy, Romania, what have you, we want that experience to be to resonate with you culturally. So as you're navigating through Netflix or Prime Video, whatever platform you are, those titles are in your language. The synopses are in your language. So you feel that the content was, you were thought of as that content process was being developed. And ultimately, the end user, we want that experience to be great because we want them to find that content that they'll love and stay on the platform. And then, of course, ultimately benefit our customers' bottom lines.
And if you're broadly, like, who would be your customer for our audience, just to try to connect the dots for them?
Sure. Yeah. So we work with Netflix, Prime Video, Sony Pictures, Hasbro Entertainment. We've worked with Disney in the past, HBO Max. So, you know, a number of the biggest players in the industry.
And from your perspective, now that you manage a cross-functional area from a growth perspective, how did that change for you, like from a personal perspective on, you know, from going from job A to job B, which is broader now, you're handling growth across multiple, you got a lot of cats to herd as a corporate language goes.
Yeah. At first it was, I mean, it's sequential as you escalate or elevate in your career, of getting used to not being the doer anymore, which is challenging because you just want to jump right in and get stuff done. So that shift was interesting for me because I like my checklists. I like getting stuff done. But now it's about stepping back and empowering others to, you know, have the opportunities for the types of experiences that I've had, to play to their strengths that I don't have, because, you know, we're all human. We have our limitations. We all excel at certain things, not at others. And so in terms of leadership, I really like to empower my teams to have autonomy and make decisions, but come to me when they do need help.
And so what does global growth mean for Word Bank? So I've seen, you know, people say focus on growth, period. But why global? And what does it mean? Like, are you looking for other markets? What would those markets look like?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, for us, global is embedded into everything that we do. And so, you know, Word Bank has been around for over 40 years. And we've had, you know, we have offices across the globe. in the U.S., primarily in the U.S. before, we were focused on U.S. companies expanding globally. And then, you know, our London office was the inverse of that. So companies in, you know, Europe or Asia trying to go the other direction. We've become much more centralized over the years, and especially as we've honed in on focusing on streaming and entertainment. So for us, it could be other markets. It could be, you know, a streamer in Korea that's trying to actually... We're having a conversation right now with the FAST channel from Japan that's wanting to expand into America to capture some of the anime market share that's in America. So as we look to grow our footprint, it's with streamers, FAST channels, AVODs, you know, even production, film production studios that are wanting to localize their content back towards the West.
And so from you know, World Bank perspective, can you give us a sense, perhaps, on how big the company is? It doesn't matter how you want to measure this, by the number of offices, by the number of employees, etc. So how big is the company?
Yeah, so we're about 80 full-time employees, and then we have a global resource network of about 2,500 resources in countries all around the globe that speak the native language. And those are graphic designers, professionals, writers, digital marketers. So in terms of, you know, full-time staff, 80 people, we have office in Denver, which is where I'm based, office in London, and a couple of outposts in Asia as well. And then PMs across the globe, which enable us to ensure the, you know, projects are always moving no matter what time of day it is.
My local, because I've had a lot of conversation on this channel, and we tend to be, as an industry, from a localization perspective, we tend to focus, generally speaking, on the most used languages, I would say. You know, I don't want to name them, but probably the Western languages and a few others that the volume tend to be. Of course, we're doing translation in 500 languages, and people claim many other language combinations that I can name.
Yep.
You know, I've had somebody on the channels saying, like, they created this particular technology that would probably in, you know, large studios, for instance, probably will not even target those languages, like sub-Saharan language, for instance. You're not going to take, you know, a big franchise movie and say, well, you know what, I'm going to localize this to, I don't know, Swahili, for instance.
Yeah.
Generally speaking, they keep it at the top level of localization from a language selection perspective. What's your take on this? What's your comment?
Yeah, I mean, you know, you need to do what makes sense for your business, of course. You know, localization is an investment. I call it an investment and not just a cost to manage, because I think that's a pitfall, as people view it as a cost to manage versus something, a strategic part of your product. You know, for us, for who we work with, we deliver in 35 languages, but historically we've, you know, delivered in up to 150 languages. If the business case is there to localize, then, you know, of course do so, but it is a balance of, you know, the investment versus the ROI on it. So yeah, but we do typically see, you know, your that 35 language set is, you know, what you would the countries that you would commonly go in.
Yeah. And on your global growth strategy, what do you think the gaps are right now that you're trying to fix?
I'm sorry, you broke up a little bit in that last
question. So yeah, I was just asking the question on the global growth strategy, Clayton. What are the gaps that you're trying to fix right now? What are the gaps in the strategy that you think we should address?
Yeah, so for World Bank in particular, or for the industry at large?
For World Bank in particular.
Okay. Yeah, sure. Yeah, so the gaps for us, so we pivoted to focus entirely on streaming and entertainment not too long ago. And so for us, the gap right now is closing ground on people who companies who have been in the industry for a long time and have their footing and relationships in Hollywood. Well, we worked with entertainment companies for a long time. I mean, the existence of World Bank going back, you know, but into the 80s. But, you know, for us, we weren't solely in the entertainment industry. So what I'm focusing on right now as a company is how do we close that gap so the industry understands and recognizes World Bank as one of the primary and one of the premier options for this type of work.
Now, you mentioned earlier that you're trying to diversify. It sounds like you're trying to diversify from the big brands down to the perhaps the new and upcoming media sources, like you mentioned. Yeah. some of the media sources, the streamers, etc. So do you feel like that's the new generation now? It's coming. What's your experience has been like working with the new waves of media companies?
Yeah, it's been really fascinating because we go to a lot of events. We talk to a lot of, you know, emerging companies, and a lot of these are centered around content creators, just because that is the era that we're living in now. And you're seeing content creators become more sophisticated in actual business practice, and they're understanding the opportunity that's out there to go global and reach global audiences. But they've never been in a situation where they needed to understand localization and what it takes. And so for us, I mean, we've worked with a lot of early stage companies throughout our history. And so we have experience in taking somebody that has no idea what they're doing and what it takes to go into another market. And so for us, that's an exciting opportunity because, of course, the established brands, you know, there's the volume there, and localization volume drives your revenue and drives profit. But there's also opportunity to start with somebody and help their global growth, which is really exciting for us as well. And with the experience that we have, the basics of starting to do this is, you know, it's built into our DNA. So helping some of these more emerging brands, whether it's a fast channel or you know, an AVOD or SVOD, or even a studio or anything like that, or a group of content creators that need this type of service, that's something that we're excited about.
And where do you sit now on the business case for localization for some of your customers? Is there a business case out there? Can a case be made? Should I localize or not localize? Do you help them through that? Or what's your perspective on business casing a localization project for one of your customers?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, for us, it's essential to do localization properly. And you can, especially in streaming and entertainment, I mean, the world has shrunk, right? Previously, when if you had a show or a movie, you would have to, you know, distribute it through theaters or through broadcast TV. And that was a big deal. It's not like anybody could produce content and just go do that, right? But the world has shrunk and you can distribute your content globally, which means you can go global much, much more quickly. And that's a good thing in from one point of view. But from the other point of view, if you rush into it without properly localizing something, one, you're potentially ruining your first impression with that market. You know, first impressions matter. Just like your launch in the US or Canada, where you're at, that matters, right? You put love and care and attention into that. So similarly, we encourage people put the same love, care, and attention into going into other markets. And beyond that, I mean, there's the obvious pitfalls of you run the risk of, you know, saying something that becomes a viral joke because you localize something poorly, or worse, the worst possible thing is you do something offensive to a particular market, and then that's kind of it. So, you know, we encourage people to, there are ways to, you know, to manage the investments. You're not having to do everything all at once, but we do encourage people to do it the right way and embed global and embed local into your global as you start to expand.
And in your world, when you endeavor to go through this process with your customers, is it primarily or largely, Clayton, a human effort, AI driven? To what extent technology is embedded with the human efforts in your localization process?
Yeah, so for us, we've built production models that deliver creativity at scale. So what that means in practicality is we're doing such high volume of creative work that we have to leverage technology in order to automate the mundane. I was speaking with our CTO earlier, and we're talking about some of the time savings that some of the tech that we've built, AI or, you know, tech before. And one of the pieces of tech that we built for title treatments, which are the logos of the cards that you see on Netflix, you know, movie shows, stuff like that. One of those pieces of tech has saved 1.5 million hours of work. So in essence, you know, that time, it benefited our end, you know, the end customer. If they had a faster turnaround time, they didn't have as much coordination time of going back and forth. For us, we're able to offer a lower price and scale faster, but humans are central to this entire experience. Even as we're getting into Gen AI creating, you know, basic designs, and of course, machine translation has been around for a long time, and now it's AI translation. You definitely run a pitfall if you don't have a human in that process, not only from an accuracy standpoint, but from a creativity standpoint, from a cultural standpoint of, you know, you need to connect with that culture. And the only way to do that is to have a native speaker in country that understands the context of everything that can make sure that it's going to connect to that local audience.
And, you know, like I speak three languages and, you know, my wife and I, sometimes we sit down and watch like movies, let's say in another language. And I can tell you, like, I can never recall any time that I watched a movie and went like 2 minutes from the, you know, following the script. And to tell you that there are mistakes in the scripts, like that's not what the actors are saying. Like I'm reading what's on the screen and I'm listening to what the actors are saying, what the movie is saying. And I'm saying, no, it doesn't match.
Yeah.
So how does that work? Do you guys get involved at that level or no, just on the marketing side?
Yeah, we're primarily on the marketing side. We do some subtitling and dubbing, but it's for short form content and it's very, very limited. We do some work with Hasbro Entertainment on some of their web content for a couple of their IPs. So yeah, on the subtitling front, you know, you do run into that as well. We hear this from our, you know, resources around the globe. You know, I know companies are going to go for maybe branded content. They invest heavily in making sure it's as accurate as possible. And then for the licensed stuff, which is only going to be on platform for a year or two, maybe they take some liberties and you know, go for a cheaper route. But, you know, you see in the news where companies solely rely on AI to do subtitles and dubbing. And you see groups of fans getting really upset by that and feeling like that level of trust has been broken with that fandom, which is not something you want.
There was a message that was posted on LinkedIn just a few weeks ago during Valentine. Somebody wanted to convey a nice message. That's the way the intention was nice, but it did not turn out to be nice. Yeah. And the Quebec region, Canada, where French is the predominant language in that region. And the message was completely misconstrued and it came out completely negative and people were commenting on it in a very negative way. So, but that was not the intention, obviously. The intention was good. The intention was positive. But again, when somebody don't understand the language that you're translating to and taking a shortcut in translation, as you know, get there fast, get there quickly, get there cheap, whatever technology you're using, whatever methodology you're using, you end up with the wrong messaging, right? That's what I'm, especially when you go global. I mean, you're talking about one region here, but if you go global, you got to deal with this endless amount of cultures, culture nuances. So from a culture nuance perspective, do you measure the culture resonance, if you will? And how does that work for you and your customers?
Yeah, so I mean, we're fitting into our clients, you know, our clients' workflow. So where we're at in the stage is, you know, we're working with our in-country resources and finalizing all of the creative, whether it's theatrical mm-hmm. assets or title treatments or synopses. From there, it goes on to, you know, the client. They go in and they're measuring everything. But we've had a lot of success in working hand in hand with our local resources and ensuring that it's going to resonate. Of course, Netflix or Prime Video, they're going to be responsible for measuring that. But it's true. I mean, what you said about the cultural nuance piece, we did a study recently. It was a small study, but we surveyed a group of streaming and entertainment executives, and we were just asking them about global growth. And the statistic that stands out the most out of this study is that 90% of them said they wanted to expand globally. Only 3% considered cultural nuance as being integral to that, which in my mind, there's such contrast to that of wanting to expand, but not understanding the cultural nuance at the local level, because I think they're inextricable.
This is shocking.
Yeah.
I'm shocked, actually. That reminds me back in the 90s when, you know, you've got companies that says back in the days, they used to say, if you can't speak English, you can't use our product. It sounds like we're back to where we started.
Yeah. We actually,
not sure.
Yeah, sorry not to cut you off, but it's been interesting because, like I said previously, we worked with a lot of different industries over the years, and you see differing levels of localization maturity. As working primarily in streaming entertainment, I mean, of course, there's the global players that are doing things very well, and they're very successful at that. But there is it tails off in terms of localization maturity, where you know you do feel like you're circling back in time a little bit and saying, okay, like we got to go back to, you know, the fundamentals in a way. So yeah, no, I hear you on that. It was surprising. And again, small sample size, but it was executive. So
it sends a signal, right?
Yeah, it sends a signal for sure.
How do you think, in your case, either for your team or maybe an advice to somebody else who's listening out there for our audience who is interested in the topic, how do you think a global team should reorganize to address perhaps the global growth, but a part of it, localization, and some back-end functions that should be probably being put into the strategy as well? Because you can't grow without production and you need all these components to fall in place. How should we reorganize if somebody is interested in listening to this advice, in your opinion?
Yeah, so for us, I mean, we kind of live by this mantra at Word Bank, which is people, process, systems in that order. You have to have the right people in place, and that means in not only within the organization, but globally in place that makes sense for your workflow. Beyond that, you need a process that's going to be able to drive this work around the globe. And then systems is, for us, it's the last piece, because we've just seen so many times throughout the years of you buy a shiny new system and try and put it in place. It doesn't work, right? You're laughing right now. I'm sure.
No, I know. I was just talking about this one in the cybersecurity domain. It's absolutely that. I mean, you see a threat, they put a firewall, and then you end up everything breaking down.
Yep. No, and I've been guilty of it early in my career of saying, yeah, if I just buy this tech, it'll solve all my problems, and it never does. So for us, you know, if you're looking at a global workflow and you want to ensure that work is moving across the globe while others are sleeping, which is the most, you know, most efficient way to get work done quickly. Maybe you have PMs in different places that can do those checks at different points of time. Maybe you have, and they can also have, you know, the inbound requests from the client or what have you. But we found a lot of success in that and structuring globally with resources, with the right resources, with a very, very dialed in process, and then the systems that support that. And two, I should say the systems are always being optimized, tinkered with. We're developing new stuff that, you know, to add on to it, to look for ways to optimize that work.
So in a global operation teams as your production teams, do you prefer or do you still value centralization versus decentralization?
Yeah, we value centralization, and especially as we're speaking to our clients.
It does not become the bottleneck, no?
Well, it depends for sure. I think in a decentralized model, especially in the streaming entertainment industry, you can end up having kind of a disparate interpretation of, well, we got to zoom in on you there.
Yeah, that's fine.
You're ready for your shot. Yeah.
It took me 2 months to figure out, like, if I move, you know, in a certain way, my camera does certain things.
Yeah.
No, my audience got used to me, I guess, zooming in, zooming out.
Yeah. Dramatic. I love it. Yeah. So with decentralization, you do run the risk of, one, you know, our resources on the client side. What we've seen with our clients is that when they're working with a number of different agencies in a number of different countries, it's just a lot of hours for them to manage all of the different agencies. So yes, I mean, in a centralized model, you can run the risk of having a bottleneck through one agency, but if you have an agency that can actually scale and do it well, then in essence, you don't have to worry about the bottleneck because the work's always flowing and being completed and coming back on time and error-free. But with that decentralized model, you know, we do have some customers that switched from a decentralized to us, and it freed them up, freed their time, which is they can focus on more strategic initiatives, or the company can choose to invest that resource into other areas of the business. So yeah, for us, it's centralized.
Now, let's talk a little bit about some guardrails for brands, right? So you got some brand guardrails, and then also there is some local cultural truth sometimes that we probably need to follow because, you know, at the end of the day, the global brand is one thing, but you're catering to a local brand or local demographics in some cases. So how do we balance the two? You know, you've got that big brand decisions to make or directions to follow, but meanwhile, you got to make sure that you're at a micro level, like at a small demographical area in some countries, that you need to follow certain things. How do you balance the two?
Yeah, I mean, it's forever the
challenge.
Yeah, thank you. I'm struggling with that word. I don't know why. Forever the challenge in this industry is, you know, how far do you drift from the brand to go into, you know, cultural connection? You know, I think it's working with the partners that we have. So there is flexibility for that initial round of, like, let's say it's a title treatment that's going to our designer in China. You know, in China, for a title treatment that's in English, you know, they have to completely deconstruct and then reconstruct, especially if it's like a 3D title or something like that, that has, you know, shadowing and stuff like that. Having that first round come back and stating those cultural considerations back to the client of saying, this, you know, this is why we did this, this is what this means. It gives the client the opportunity and, you know, puts the power in their hands to say, we're comfortable with making that decision, or no, we want to go the safer route, and we'd rather stick closer to the original IP versus go more in a cultural direction. We delivered, I think it's close to 900,000 localized title treatments in this last year. And so there are thousands of those micro decisions going back and forth between, you know, in country and the end client. And it's really fascinating because there is a lot of decisioning to make, but at the end of the day, there is fast go-to-market times. You know, the content needs to go out on platform. So we lean in on being the connector between our clients and those cultural considerations.
Is there a fear, in your opinion, of losing the brand consistency when accommodating local campaigns?
You know, with I think with IP that's as large as some of the stuff that we're working on, for example, with Sony Pictures, we do some digital advertising campaigns to help promote in certain regions. And you stick close to the brand and the IP because these are big releases, big global releases. So I would say within this particular industry, you're more likely to stay safer on the brand side than you are to, you know, truly creatively localize something. I think when you get down into, we have some fun examples from our resources where they talk about chances they took or whatever that did end up getting approved because it was so thoughtful and so nuanced. But with something like a Stranger Things, you want to play it safe with that brand identity.
Now, is there a, or perhaps maybe there isn't, but let's say there is a structural governance in place or models in place to balance the brand and local relevance. I'm assuming that would be like the communication with your customers, or maybe there are some other measures in place.
Yeah, no, that's built into the workflow, communication with our customers. And yeah, you know, in processing this many files daily, I mean, it is, you know, sometimes really fast, rapid fire decisioning. So working with our partners and having that really close relationship and knowing that what's coming back that may be leaning more culturally connected, but less brand. Those considerations are laid out really clearly, and we give our customers the opportunity to approve, disapprove.
Clayton, let's talk about the elephant in the room. Where are you with AI now?
Yeah, I mean, AI is embedded into our workflow. Yeah, I mean, for us, it's the next, we've always been tech forward, right? We've always been building our own systems to solve problems. We've always wanted to automate the mundane. We consistently say in all company meetings, if you're doing the same thing a couple of times in a row manually, let's automate that. Because you don't need to be spending that time doing it. So we've integrated in our workflows and also too in just R&D and how we're exploring, how we're building tech. And two, we've seen it as an opportunity with our clients who are starting to use Gen AI for simple things. Is some companies would view that as taking work away, but for us, we're looking at it as an opportunity of what does that mean for us in terms of opportunity? So just because something was created from Gen AI does not mean it's perfect or culturally connected, so that there's a QC opportunity for us and there's not, you know, to connect in that way. So we're very pro AI. For us, it is, you know, it's the force multiplier for delivering creative at scale. And at the end of the day, we want to, again, automate the mundane and increase turnaround times, which empowers creatives and humans to work on more stuff that they want to work on. Because at the end of the day,
I was just going to say, like, a human in the loop is big in the localization industry, and not just in the localization, in every industry, a human is interacting with bots, agents, AI in general. So you see a little bit of friction, and it depends on who you're talking to, right? So it depends on how AI is being used, how is it being deployed. Some people give you different opinions, right? So, but you can, the 100% true right now is there's a friction. There's tension between, you know, the people who are saying AI sucks because we did not install it correctly or we did not use it properly in the right way. I founded a company called N49 Networks in November, and one of the biggest thing we're doing right now is AI automation and agentic development and bot development, etc. So you can see that, and I'm, you know, as soon as I have a conversation with somebody, what do you think of AI? Well, depends on who you're talking to. Some people give you like the negative version of AI. That means you either did not use it well, or you did not install it correctly, you did not buy the right license, et cetera. There's many reasons why, right? But it is the lack of education on every side, on every, the user and the customer, et cetera. Yeah. So are you guys getting involved in that, resolving some of those tensions, some of those frictions?
Yeah. You know, we've approached it since the beginning with a very curious mindset in how can we utilize this? It's never been for the mindset of, you know, how do we utilize it to, you know, take work away from our resources or anybody internally. It's always been from the standpoint of, you know, how can this make everybody's life easier? How can you do, you know, automate things you shouldn't be doing and focus on more strategic initiatives instead? And for us, what's really been beneficial, there was a, you know, company mandate to start utilizing things, but there were strict guardrails set out by our CTO and our ITS team in that, you know, we have local instances of certain LLMs where people can feel comfortable entering, you know, more sensitive information versus, you know, you read all the horror stories of somebody putting something into ChatGPT and it's out in the world now. And so for us, that model has really worked. We've seen there's so many inspiring stories of people who, you know, 10 years ago, if they didn't have this skill set, would never be able to do what they did, you know, last month, which is really inspiring because you're seeing people be able to produce stuff with Cloud Code or whatever it is. And so, you know, for the younger generations that are just coming in, I think there's so much opportunity. You could produce things that formerly people would have had 10 years experience to figure out how to produce. And so I view it very positively, just because I know that for us and for me personally, I want humans doing more of what they enjoy and less of the stuff that we don't enjoy. And I think that's been the role of tech by and large over the years anyways.
Now, creating value, I think that's what you're alluding to, in creating value for your customers or for your staff or for your team members. And so how do we go about, how did you solve that? Like from a creating value, how did you define the creating value part? Because when you know how it goes, right? So when automation goes in and automation is being used prevalent in a big way, then the commoditization of those services becomes a little bit more aggressive. And now we got to talk about what value do we bring as professionals, as human in the industry. It doesn't matter which industry. This, I guess this is ubiquitous. It goes everywhere.
Yeah, absolutely. For us, it's not just value. It's the speed to value. So how quickly can you produce value for your customers? And so, you know, the example I gave previously of the, you know, the 1.5 million hours saved, the way we're looking at it and measuring is, you know, how much time are we saving? How much more quickly are we delivering back to our end client? If they had a 3-day turnaround time and we're delivering in 1 day consistently, all of a sudden that opens up other lines of work they may have that they want to, you know, send our way versus maybe another competitor who is still taking the 3-day turnaround time. So as we're looking at automation, it is, how do we benefit our end customer as fast as humanly possible? And that is through faster turnaround time. But then it's also through price restructuring and saying, look, we're able to do this a lot faster and a lot of it's automated. So we're able to cut you a break on price. That's just excellent customer experience, right? And that's central to everything that we do, is just a fanatical about customer experience. And in that, you end up growing a lot with your existing customers, more so than you would if you tried to avoid AI or automations.
How's business for you guys right now? Like, I should have asked this earlier, but how is business? How are you seeing the market right now? Are you guys growing? Where are you at?
Yeah. So business is good for us. We're doing well. We are, you know, we're well situated within the industry and working with some of the biggest players in the industry. So it is going well. And we are, I would say, maybe uniquely positioned in that, you know, we are a larger organization, but we're small. We're able to act nimbly, more in a startup mentality than, you know, very, very large companies that are, you know, have been doing, especially like the subtitling and dubbing agencies who are legacy and they can't pivot as fast as we can. So we have a unique value proposition, which has paid off for us. And yeah, business is good.
Good. And what differentiates, and let's talk a little bit about your clients, for instance, what differentiates clients that expands, let's say, into 20 markets? I mean, I'm using 20, but could be like 25, 30, whatever. Successfully, versus those who stalls, for instance, why do they stall if they don't?
Yeah. I would say, I mean, with the streaming industry, I would say that it's largely based on cost, typically, you know.
Okay.
So
budget comes knocking.
Budget comes knocking always, no matter what. No, you know, you'll see people have tremendous success and then whatever, you know, content, you know, people's content interest shift and certain IP becomes deprioritized. We've seen that with, you know, with some companies that have maybe like a smaller set of languages that they're focusing on, and maybe it's you know, micro content or web content. But yeah, budget's always going to be a concern because, you're a longtime localization guy. When budgets start getting cut, localization is often one of the first things that gets a red question mark next to. So I'd say outside of that, it's you know, just the continued dedication to doing things and doing things the right way, which do inevitably get affected by budget, unfortunately.
So, you know, you mentioned budget earlier, like, and you talked about perhaps you seeing localization or translation in general as an expense versus an enabler for revenue generation. And there's a lot of business cases out there. You know, our audience can look them up by Googling the business case for localization in any industry. Now, that information is available out there. There is valid studies on if you translate, if you localize to other demographics, you increase your revenue. There's plenty of evidence for that. In your opinion, it's just, why does that happen? Like, what, you know, when somebody says, yeah, budget is getting tight, let's erase localization. But meanwhile, when you look at the expense statement for any company, for any initiative, localization is a tiny expense. I mean,
yeah,
it's not that big.
No, I, you know, I'm not sure why companies, I mean, I've been a marketer for 20 years. And so localization and then marketing, of course, is the other thing.
How did you deal with that when you were in another industry, for instance? I know you've held positions in other industries. Were you localizing back then, or was it even on your radar?
No, in other industries, I was working just advertising to North American customers. So, I mean, back then when people would approach cutting marketing costs, the argument is always, you know, how are you going to sell more without people knowing what your product is or where they could buy it? And with localization, it's, you know, it's the same story, but inevitably, for some reason, companies often look at those two costs as opportunities to cut back. Myself as a marketer and as a localization guy, I would say that's the wrong approach. I would say lean in further. And, you know, the more you invest into localization and the more culturally connected your end user feels to your product, the more likely they are to buy it. It's not the other way around. And you're right, there's so many countless studies on how much more likely people are to buy something or engage with something if it's in their native language, even if they speak English.
How do you think we should embed the localization model into the revenue model? That's probably easier said than done, but I'd love your take on this one.
So it's funny because I've been working on looking at, you know, the cost of poor quality in a number of ways. So, I mean, people obviously look towards something as basic as subscriber count or whatever that is. So if you're looking at churn rate, right, you launch in a country, a bunch of people sign up, nothing's localized properly, so they churn and they leave. An ad-supported model, it is that time spent watching content. So if they're not engaged with your platform, you're not selling ads. But then beyond everything, I think that's like the obvious market connection of users doing X. But on the other side, you have what's the internal cost of poor quality? How much time is it taking your teams to manage agencies and go back and forth and say, no, this, you know, this doesn't work. We got to send it back. Now you're beyond turnaround time and go to market time. Now things are running late. So there's both a, you know, there's a market cost, and then there is an absolute internal team cost that I think people don't factor in a lot of the time.
You know, it just sort of like, since I started in an industry like 25 years ago, almost, it just baffles me to think about, you know, a project, let's say whatever project, in your case, maybe a media piece that costs whoever is launching, you know, the company who's launching this, Netflix, et cetera, say $1 million on an average per piece, or maybe two, I don't know. And then when it comes to localization bill, it's, let's say, $10,000. And, you know, they agonize over $10,000 spend on a $2 million project. I just don't get that. I just don't understand. And the communication piece is so sensitive. If you dress it up in a language, if you dress up your project in a language that your audience is going to understand,
yep,
it would make a huge difference in the brand, in the project that you're embarking on or you're trying to launch in those markets.
Yeah, absolutely. 100% agree. Totally on the same page. And I've had those moments in my career where, you know, you raise an eyebrow a little bit. We're really fortunate to work with the clients that we do in that they understand how much this is central to connecting globally. The local piece of that is just essential. And, you know, you see that in, like, take for Stranger Things. I mean, you see the global success of that, not only from the raw numbers, but you look at these like subsets of cultural moments where, I'm forgetting her name, Kate Bush, her song, Running Up That Hill. After that was on, it charted in, I mean, of course, it charted in the US, Canada, but in countries like Argentina, Brazil, Austria. And so there is a cultural connection to content. And for us, we always go back to, what's the first moment that you have in discovering content? It is that little rectangle on the screen. And if that user in that country feels compelled to click on it, you know, it could make or break that global success of that IP.
You know, you're absolutely correct. It's that first impression, right? So about whatever you're trying to sell or trying to promote, yeah, it's that first impression that makes you engage, especially with entertainment content, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
It's not like you're selling toothpaste.
Yeah.
It's not you're selling consumer products. You're selling a story, an idea. You're trying to engage emotion. You're trying to engage local relevance into the content that you're trying to promote, which is fascinating. If the amount of money that you would probably, as a budget, you probably spend on this is just too little to speak of versus, yeah, the impact that you would have on whoever your audience are. We've seen it in every product, in every industry, but in the media industry resonate more because most of it is based on, do I connect with the product, with the content, yes or no? And that's what's, yeah, going to make me engage the next level.
Yeah, absolutely.
So what is, in your opinion, Clayton, the strategic competence global brands must build in the next 5 years?
I'm sorry, can you repeat that?
What is the strategic competence global brands must build or put in place over the next 5 years to win internationally?
That's a large question. Yeah, so I mean, you know, without rehashing too much of what we've already talked about, I think it's realizing the importance of local driving global growth, that you can't go global without thinking about the local considerations first. Of course, I say that broadly. Of course, you can launch globally. Technically, you can. But your success depends on how much you are considering that local culture that you're targeting. And this is not so, you know, there, again, to go back to what I said, we can help people at different levels, and it's not a huge investment right up front all the time. There are small things that companies can do that can take baby steps in the right direction. But for large global organizations, it is thinking about not only how are they going to, within the streaming industry, how are they going to distribute that content, but how is it going to connect at the local level? How is it going to inspire somebody to stay on that platform and not churn? Foundational to that is working with local humans. Even as AI progresses and becomes more sophisticated and takes out a lot of the production work, you will always need human oversight in there, because culture shifts, culture changes. It changes down to the zip code level, down to the neighborhood level.
100%.
I think there's an opportunity here where people previously we would go, maybe you could just go broadly into France, and now because of automation, you can go broadly into France, but now you can dial into different communities within France. So there's a very strategic play here that I think a lot of companies aren't seeing, is that instead of looking at it as cutting costs and just going into France or whatever country, but you can now think about how can I really localize to all of the different cultures within that particular country, which previously was too expensive to do. But the costs involved in that and having multiple different levels of localization for different cultures was really costly. And companies do it, but not everybody could. So I think AI and automation is providing that opportunity to say, okay, how do I connect even deeper? Which should be fun for everybody. That should be an exciting moment to really connect with
100%. People. Because it's opening a huge doors now that we probably in the past, we never had those doors open, right? So it allows us to engage in a different way. It opens our creativity. We're learning faster now. I mean, one of the things we talk about is automation, but we don't talk enough about how much AI is teaching us, to be honest with you. In my case, at least, I mean, just anecdotally, I started my career as a programmer. I was a coder, and I left that like for 30, 40 years. I never touched that. When I came back to it and I said, okay, well, I'm trying to take a shot at it and see if I can do it. And within like a few days, I was able to go back into it and start coding again, all because AI has put in front of me ways to learn it. So it is there for the taking, and there's the tools available for us to do whatever we want to do in the future. And I, you know, encourage people, as you probably did, to take advantage of all the tools that are available for us in a conscious way, obviously, in an ethical way. Don't use these tools for the negative, we use them for the positive. So in the future right now, let's look ahead, I guess, from your perspective, Clayton. What are you paying attention to that most leaders are ignoring, perhaps?
I think for us, as I look, I mean, 5 years, with as fast as AI is moving right now, 5 years is sometimes hard to imagine what it might look like. But, I've always viewed any kind of technological evolution of what's on the backside of that. What are the opportunities going to be, whether it's for an individual in their career or it's for an organization at large, looking at what's being taken away versus what are the opportunities with what's being taken away, I think is a frame of mind that you have to flip in order to continue to be successful, because business landscape is changing. There's no doubt it has changed rapidly in the past 2 years. There's no two ways about it. So looking ahead is just understanding where things are going, and the output of things that are coming from AI will still need work, but it's just different work. So how can you pivot and how can you still provide a value add to that is critical in your thinking.
So you know what? I can't believe we've been talking like for 49 minutes. I'm looking at the recording time here. It's such a fascinating conversation. It's sort of like every time I talk about localization, I get really passionate about it. I want to talk about it more. So I really appreciate your time. Just as we, you know, come to the end here of our time, is there anything else you'd like to add? Is there anything that I have not covered that you'd like to cover?
Well, I think the main thing is, you know, just driving home that, you know, the local culture matters. It doesn't matter what industry that you're in. When companies are expanding globally and making these plans for go to market, to understand that local connection, that local consumer, it's an imperative for you as you plan everything out. So if I could leave one, you know, one lasting word of wisdom or something like that, that's what I would say. But no questions for you. And I've had an absolute blast. I can't believe we're at 50 minutes already as well. I could go on for another hour if you want.
Same here. Maybe we should get you back in for another conversation. We'd love to have you back. And thank you so much, Clayton, for joining me.
Yeah, thank you for having me on. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for your time. For the audience, thank you so much for joining us for this episode. I really appreciate your time. If you're coming on YouTube, thanks for watching us. If you're coming on our podcast channel, which for the past few months now, since November, I think we're approaching 100,000 downloads. Thanks for making me part of your journey. I really appreciate it. And I'll see you guys at the next episode. Clayton, Warwick, thank you so much for joining me.